Psalm 78. I want to bring you a message today, put some things together in one message that I've never done quite this way before. But I want to speak to you today about developing a multi-generational mentality. God is a multi-generational God. In the Old Testament and into the New, he is known as the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He is a multi-generational God looking over the span of humanity. And if we have his heart, we too, whether we are 20-year-old singles or 80-year-old great-grandparents, we too will have a multi-generational mentality. And if we are to see God's purposes fulfilled on the earth, and if mercy culture is to see God's purposes fulfilled as a local church, we too must have a multi-generational mentality. Psalm 78, we're going to read a few verses. Oh, my people, hear my teaching. Listen to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter hidden things from of old, what we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, the power and the wonders he has done. So notice, we will tell the next generation what we've seen God do. We will speak of his mighty power. Verse 5. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. I remember the first time spending time with an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family. So I mean the ones that are incredibly devoted and religious. You'd recognize the men with the black coats and the long beards. Families living by very, very strict codes of life with tremendous discipline. And for us, looking at it, it would seem very legalistic. And I was talking to this Jewish man, this Orthodox Jewish man, and I was asking him, okay, why do you do what you're doing? I wanted to share the gospel with him and give my perspective about my life being changed and walking with God. And he said something, I learned it from my father, who learned it from his father. I'm going to pass it on to my children. In his mind, it went all the way back to Moses. My father learned it from his, all the way back to Moses, and I'm going to pass this on. Now, obviously, in terms of me bringing the gospel to him, I felt it was a deficient answer. But in terms of having a mentality that is also scriptural, it was a very scriptural way of thinking. I am passing on to the next generation, which was passed on to me, and in his mind, went all the way back to Moses. When you look at some of the laws, some of the things that God established in Israel, like the Passover, why do you do it this way? So that your children will say, why are we doing this? What's the meaning of this? And then you, in turn, tell your children, the reason we do this is because our God brought our forefathers out of Egypt. The reason we eat unleavened bread is to remember this. The reason we do this, the slaughter of the lamb, is to remember this. This was built into the system. Even the Sabbath and the weekly lifestyle was all built in to constantly teach about who God was in the past so that you would know this same God today. We read at the end of Joshua 24, remember Joshua leads the children of Israel into the promised land. It says that the children of Israel served God as long as Joshua was alive and as long as the elders were alive who had seen and experienced the miracles of God. But when they died out because they somehow did not adequately transmit this reality to the next generation fell away. Every generation must have its own encounter with God. Grandpa's stories are wonderful, but unless you get to know Grandpa's God for yourself, it will fall short. Maybe my generation encountered God a certain way because of which we live a certain holy lifestyle by God's grace, but if we don't bring you into that same experience with God, our holy lifestyle will be legalistic bondage to you. It'll be something to be fought and resisted as opposed to be something to be embraced as beautiful. Every generation in Israel that did not have its own encounter with God fell away and backslid and worshiped idols and turned away from the one true God. Here, look in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. These words are prayed daily by traditional Jews. It is called the Shema, which in Hebrew is hear. Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. The Lord, our God, the Lord is one. But notice what's said here. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. Right now, many of you are single. Some of you will be called to be single for a period of your life or maybe all of your life. Most will be called into marriage, but all must have a multi-generational mentality. All must understand the importance of receiving from God, living this out, and transmitting to the next generation. When I got saved, the end of 1971, it was in the height of what's called the Jesus People Movement or the Jesus Revolution. I got caught up in the counterculture revolution of the 60s. There's an old saying, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. Young people don't get it, just ask some of the older ones and they'll explain it. I got caught up in the counterculture rebellion of the 60s and then got saved in the Jesus Revolution of the early 70s, as so many other hippies and radicals and rebels did. But at that time, there was tremendous excitement about Jesus coming back any minute. There was a book that had become a national bestseller written by Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth. And on the one hand, God used the book because it got people seeing that the Bible was relevant and the Bible spoke to our lives and our situation and our world. On the other hand, a lot of the prophetic expectation was that it's going to happen right now. Listen, I got saved at 16. I can guarantee you, I was not thinking about how I was going to feel when my 18-year-old granddaughter went off to college. But that's about to happen in a few days. I was not thinking what it was going to feel like to be married for more than 43 years, but that's what we've celebrated this past year. I wasn't thinking of any of that because Jesus was coming at any minute. I wasn't thinking about getting a 4-year college degree, let alone a PhD. That was not on my radar at all because Jesus was coming soon. Jerusalem was back in Jewish hands, Six-Day War in 1967. I believe that was a prophetic significance, but still, that was in place. We saw the rebellion of the 60s and said, this is the last days falling away. This is obviously the last days apostasy that the New Testament talks about. Everything's becoming unglued. Everything's falling into place with Russia, this and that. The handwriting's on the wall. Jesus is coming any minute. Friends, that's almost 48 years ago. How many here are 48 and younger? Raise your hands. A whole lot of you. How many of you are 35 and younger? How many of you are 20 and younger? Okay, watch this. All the young people, watch this. How many of you are 65 or older? Raise your hand. See, we can still raise our hands. No, I'm just messing with you. I'm 64, but I'm just messing with you. I want you to hear this. It's crucial. It's so important, especially for Mercy Culture with a multi-generational calling and leading into your anointing service tonight for families. Please hear me. And let me say again, singles have an important role. Some of the greatest time in my life was before I was married, before I was in colleges, having hours to seek God and be with God. And if you're not married yet, if you don't have children yet, there's a lot that you can do as a single person and that God wants to enrich your life with, whether he calls you to that for life or for a season. But you are part of a larger family. If you're not part of a larger family, get part of one, because God does not want you isolated. Amen? But this is a tragic reality. Most of the people that came to faith when I did in the early 70s, in this mass harvest in the Jesus People movement, I mean, the secular world was writing about it. It was cover story, June of 1971, on Time Magazine, Jesus Revolution. Staggering to see what God did. Miraculous salvations. People high on LSD having visions of the Lord and getting saved. And every imaginable type of encounter from people into all kinds of weird religious beliefs. The Lord was meeting us and saving us. Yet the vast majority of those that got saved when I did, in the local church where I got saved, and then across America and around the world, the vast majority subsequently fell away. I'm talking about people who were genuinely saved. The majority fell away. Why? As I look back, I see that in these churches where so many of us got saved, there were no new wineskins for the new wine. In other words, people were coming in from every different background. And yes, it was fine that we were a traditional church and singing the old hymns, and we didn't have any of the stuff you have here today, a piano player and people in suits and ties and ladies in dresses. And that was perfectly fine. Let us come out of our old world. But yet there was a sense that there were no new wines, because there was no recognition that God was bringing in these new people. And then secondly, there was very little real discipleship. It seems that the strong made it, or the ones that could make it better on their own, and others that had other issues or were more sensitive or more questions, many of them didn't make it. And then the third thing, there were very few spiritual fathers. And I look back at what happened in this generation. And yes, there was a dramatic shift. Psychologist David Myers pointed out that if you fell asleep in the year 1960 and woke up in the year 2000, you'd wake up to the divorce rate doubled, teen suicide tripled, reported violent crime up 4 times, prison population up 5 times, children born out of wedlock up 6 times, people living together out of wedlock up 7 times. And the vast majority of that shift just happened from the early 60s to the early 70s. Yes, it was a time of massive cultural shift, but the church didn't recognize what was happening. The church didn't recognize the uniqueness of the hour, and what the church saw was rebellion, and it was there, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and Eastern religion, that was all there, but the church didn't recognize that behind that was a deep spiritual cry, that young people were saying, there's got to be more. There's got to be more than just having a good job and a good education so my kids can have a good job and a good education so that their kids can have a good job. There's got to be more. And the devil seized the moment with every type of perversion, with every type of distraction, with every type of fleshly interest, creative things going in the wrong ways. The devil sees the moment, but so much of the church only saw the superficial and the outward and didn't realize what was happening behind the scenes and didn't properly father this new movement. And one reason if the church failed then was it didn't have a sufficient multi-generational mentality, because we're out of here any minute. I mean, come on, think of it. Think of it. If God, here, you're traveling, you stay in a hotel for one night. The hotel's a little bit run down, the room's badly decorated, so whatever. You're there one night, you're out. If you stay there for a week, you might start fixing the pictures on the wall, just kind of like, oh, there's... Or tell the front desk, you know, it's a little dirty here. If you're staying there for a month, you're going to have a different attitude. If you're not going to buy the place and take it over, a totally different attitude. So many of us, just because we think we got to be ready for the second coming and ready for eternity and all that, we forget that right now this is our home. So look, I still live with urgency to see the Lord. I want to see Jesus come back in my lifetime. By God's grace, I want to run strong for decades ahead. I mean, I'm thriving and blessed. And literally, God knows, I feel far younger and energetic and blessed today at 64 than I did 10 years ago. I mean, easily. Probably than I did 20 years ago. I'm truly thriving and blessed. But I want to see it all happen in my lifetime. But see, here's the mentality. Here's the mentality. I'm running in a relay race, and I don't know what stage of the race I'm in. In other words, you know, maybe it's the fastest relay of all, the 4x100. So you're going to have your fastest sprinters. The guy starts, you know, sprinting 100 meters, and then he passes the baton to the second guy 100 meters, and then you have your closer. The last one, he grabs it and brings it home. Or you have a 4x400. You have different things like that. So each one, they have to run their very, very best and fastest. They have to be able to grab the baton, pass it on. So my goal, I want to be the closer. In other words, I hope you all feel the same. I want to run and then hand the baton to Jesus. And he said, that's it. We're done. We're done. We're out of here. It's over. That's the goal, that the kingdom purposes are accomplished in our lifetime and we see Jesus. But either way, I'm running with all my might as best as I can. If it's a mile race or 10 mile or 50 or a sprint, I'm going to pace myself accordingly and then hand the baton. I may be handing it to Landon, or Landon may be handing it to you. Or we may be handing it to Jesus. Either way, I'm going to run my race the same way. I'm going to run my race. I'm going to be pouring into the next generation. I'm going to be pouring into my kids, pouring into my grandkids, pouring into great-grandkids, physically, spiritually, whatever lies ahead, at the same time living with urgency. So many of us, we can't do either. You know, we don't know how to just be at home and enjoy the blessings of God here, and we don't know how to live with urgency. You know, how do we do both? Hey, it's simple. I only got one life. Only have one life to repay my debt of gratitude to Jesus for dying for me and being so merciful and kind and loving. Only have one life to touch this dying world. Our missions director often says, I don't know if this is the last generation, but it's our last generation. We each have one crack at it. Therefore, there's urgency because it's a dying, messed up, lost, and hurting world. On the other hand, if I'm going to be staying somewhere for 80 or 90 years, I'm not going to have the mentality I do at one night in a hotel. Take a look with me in 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 18. I never noticed this verse until a friend pointed it out to me. A friend who's a great soul winner and disciple maker, and has a wonderful multi-generational mentality. 2 Samuel 18:18. During his lifetime, Absalom, son of David, had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. Wow. Elsewhere, we read that he had three sons, so they must have died. But because he had no offspring, all right, and you can have physical offspring, or you can have spiritual offspring. We're all called to reproduce one way or another. And many of us will have both, physical and spiritual. But because he did not have offspring, what did he do? He built a monument and named it after himself. That's what you're left with. There's no living legacy after that. It's a dead monument with your name on it. I was speaking at a pastor's meeting in one particular city, and God laid on my heart to address this theme, not exactly the same way as today, but this larger theme. And I read this verse, and I had known some of these men. Fine men, devoted men, live sacrificially, love their congregations. But now they're older than me, and you could see some of them were fading a bit. And I said to them, how many of you have raised up spiritual sons to succeed you and to lead the ministry after you? And they just kind of looked down, shook their heads. I thought, wow, these are good men. These are men that love the Lord. These are men who have sacrificed, but somehow they've always lived as if it's all going to end in their lifetime, and they're not thinking, okay, have I raised up other sons that have sent them out to reproduce here and reproduce there? Have I raised up spiritual daughters to go out and reproduce here and reproduce there? Is there someone who can take this beyond where I've taken it? And what happens often when the big name is gone, then the thing dies, ends up being named after ourselves. That's what happens when you don't have spiritual sons and daughters. Now take a look at this, Psalm 127. Psalm 127. It's something we can read, and we read it as if it's two separate psalms, even though it's so short, as if it's two separate subjects. But it's all one. Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. In vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat, for he grants sleep to those he loves. Sons are a heritage from the Lord, children a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate. You say, well, what's the connection between the beginning and the end of that verse? About 15 years ago, not long after we had moved from Pensacola, Florida to North Carolina, from New York originally, my wife Nancy and I are from New York, and then we served in different parts of the country, and now we were being called to North Carolina. And it had been after a very exhausting and taxing and intense season, and I was physically weary. And I'm a late night person. If someone invites me to 6 a.m. prayer, I say, I'd love to do it. It's just a little hard to stay up that late. And when I'm really thriving, when I'm in one of these supernatural writing modes, I'll literally go to sleep at 4:30 in the morning. So ideally, I don't start my day the next day until mid-morning. If I have to get up earlier, I try to catch a nap later in the day. Well, I was on my typical late-night schedule. I had a lunch appointment with one of my closest colleagues. He's like a younger brother to me spiritually, but really holds my hands up and is very loyal. And we had a lunch appointment, and God had laid Psalm 127 on his heart, and I just slept. I slept through whatever. Either alarm set for the wrong. I just kept sleeping. When I woke up, it was lunchtime. I mean, I just never sleep that late. But I woke up totally refreshed. And I shot him a note. I said, man, I am so sorry. You're not going to believe this. I slept through lunch. I woke up and I was supposed to be with you. And he goes, Mike, Psalm 127. He said, you have sons. And I realized, okay, hang on. On the one hand, if God doesn't do the work, we're sunk. But then God gives his beloved rest. In other words, this is not our work. This is his work. We can only go, look, I push, I go for it, but I understand it's the salvation of the world's not hanging on my shoulders or your shoulders. And the success of your business, it's not all hanging on you. So there's rest, but where do the sons tie in? When you have sons, godly daughters, you can rest while they fight the battles. And what he was saying was, this was all from the Lord. You know, this was a sign from God, let your sons do some of the work while you rest. There is something that happens that every night when I go to sleep at night, the work of the gospel that I've been involved with is continuing just the same, because by God's grace, we have raised up spiritual sons and daughters, and they are out preaching the gospel all over the world. And they planted fire schools and planted churches and are helping orphans and fighting against sex trafficking and so many things that would be important to you. They're doing day and night. We have our largest team. The team that we oversee, almost all of them sent out through our ministry school. Our largest team is in the Philippines, several different locations, but a total, if you include children, over 50 men, women, and children just in the Philippines. And some of them have been there almost 20 years now. And they have a ministry school. They have a fire school of ministry in the Philippines. And when I went there, my last trip to the Philippines, we were meeting with all of our workers. It was amazing to hear the testimonies and see firsthand what they're doing. But all the students from the ministry school came up to me with big smiles. They said, hello, grandfather. They said, we are the children of your spiritual children. And they're reproducing, and it's all the same spiritual heritage. So while I'm sleeping at night, the gospel is burning through folks that we've touched. It's multi-generational. As we were having our first daughter, she was born in 1977. Nancy and I got married in 76 and then had girls in 77 and 78. And I decided, you know, I should read some good books on fathering and Christian books on this and learn better. I had a great earthly father, but, you know, want to learn more in all this. And I got this one book, and there was one chapter in the book that I've never forgotten. And it was called No Day Is Ever Wasted. I believe the book was The Effective Father. And the chapter was No Day Is Ever Wasted. And In that story, in that chapter, they tell the story of a man that became very well known in early American history. And he would often talk about this day that he spent with his father. He went fishing with his father. And him spending the day with his father, his dad talking to him, it changed his life. And he always spoke of that. He would frequently reference that day with my dad when I went fishing and what it meant to him. So years later, his biographers wanted to find out more. They found the father's journal. They found the father's journal. So they went to that date that the son often spoke about, and to their shock, read the journal entry that said, "Went fishing with my son today, a day wasted." And I thought about that and said, you never know the impact that you're going to have. You never know just a few minutes of quality time together and how someone that's really looked to you and respected you in a moment of time, that's all gone because of the way you treated them. Or the disinterest that you showed in them. Or whatever else was there. One of my dear friends ran into a well-known friend of mine the other day and said, "Hey, I went up to him to say hi to him, but he was very unfriendly." I said, "Did you tell him you're a good friend of mine?" He said, "I never got that far." So I joked with him. I said, "Next time, name drop first, and I'll be more friendly." But that is obviously going to color the way he looks at this guy. And now when he'll read what he writes or see him somewhere, it's like, eh. And I've thought of that, and I've thought of it even more effectively with my grandchildren than with children, because, you know, the grandchildren, you're the hero. You do all the things that the parents don't do, you know, won't do, and feed them all the stuff the parents don't want them to, you know, you do all that. And then when you're done, you don't have to discipline them or anything. You just hand them back, you know, and you're like the hero. But I was moved to tears. Our oldest granddaughter, as I mentioned, is 18, about to head off to college. And I had taken her last year, she and her older cousin, to London for a few days on a ministry trip, used miles of mine, flew them over and even let them, they stayed in London and did some touring and things like that while I was ministering elsewhere. And then the year before that, I brought them over to Sicily and Rome, so they had these great experiences. So I got this really beautiful card from one side. They each wrote something after the London trip thanking me. So one from my granddaughter's older cousin and the other from my granddaughter. And at the end of the note from my granddaughter, she signed it saying, "The best is yet to come." Well, that's what I've been famous for years. In certain circles, I'm infamous. Like, will you stop saying that already? You know, it's like, why are you so optimistic? Why are you so full of faith? I said, unless I'm going to hell, the best is yet to come. You know, it's pretty simple to me. It's an easy one. But I found out subsequently that that had been her motto before she heard it from me. It's like in the blood. It's been transmitted in that way. And you think you maximize these little moments. You never really know that just being together in a loving, caring way changes people's lives. I want to say this to Mercy Culture as a whole. Be sensitive to folks that come in here in need. It may be providential that you sit down for a meal. It may not be about you. It may be about them. It may be that somebody came here wondering, does anybody care? I'm about to kill myself. Does anybody care? And they just happen to find mercy. What is mercy culture? Okay, let's see if this church cares and that meal you have with them saves their lives. No day is ever wasted. My book, Jezebel's War with America, comes out on Tuesday. And when we speak of Jezebel, we know she was a wicked queen in the Bible. She was a pagan princess who married an ungodly king of Israel, King Ahab. We know the text says that she incited him to do evil, so she provoked him to be even worse. You could look at her as a pioneer radical feminist, not feminist in a term of esteeming and recognizing women and equal pay for a woman doing the same job as a man. No, I mean a radical destructive feminism that emasculates men. That's what she did. She was murderous. She killed the prophets. She's associated with sexual immorality, with sorcery in 2 Kings 9. And we know as an idol worshiper in the ancient world, baby killing was associated with idolatry. Jesus mentions someone calls her Jezebel in the New Testament. And she too, false prophetess, is a false spirituality. She's associated with sexual immorality and idolatry. And last year, the light just went on in a dramatic way, connect the dots of what's happening in America. The turning away from God and the plunging into idolatry, and with that, the militant baby-killing spirit. We're not talking about a 13-year-old girl who was raped by her uncle and she's in agony. What do I do? Do I have an abortion? We're not talking about an agonizing, difficult situation like that. We're talking about shout your abortion, pound on the Supreme Court doors during the Kavanaugh hearings. It's just a tumor. Just get rid of it. Laugh about it. So you have the rise of idolatry, the rise of a militant baby-killing spirit. You have the seduction of a nation through porn, epidemic levels. Some of you here are struggling for your life to break free. Children as young as 8 being exposed to it. We've never had anything like this. We have the rise of witchcraft and sorcery. There are right now supposed to be more witches in America than Presbyterians. And they're gathering together to hex the patriarchy. The hate in man ties in with the radical feminist spirit. With radical feminism is also the emasculating of men. So for a man to want to be the godly head of his home today, that's toxic masculinity. And for a woman to be a woman, that's despised. So there's a war on gender trying to turn men into women and women into men. There's the silencing of the prophetic voices, Jezebel associated with intimidating by fear. People so afraid to speak out for fear of consequences. And the shame of it is, as our brothers and sisters in other nations are literally having their heads chopped off for the gospel, we don't speak out because we don't want to be unfriended on Facebook. It's pathetic. Even the fascination with sorcery. I was checking on because of our book coming out and saw that it was on some bestseller lists on Amazon. So I was looking at one of the top 100 books on Amazon right now, just out of curiosity. And somehow they have a category, most read. There's most sold and most read. I don't know how they compute that, but most read. And you know that 6 out of the 10 most read books currently listed by Amazon are Harry Potter books? All these years later. You know, the children's fascination with sorcery and all this, even if it's not as overtly evil, it's still not about Jesus. It's still another kind of spirituality. You see all this happening, and Jezebel does not have a multi-generational mentality. Radical feminists hate the family system, hate the idea of mothers bearing children and husbands and wives together. The militant pro-abortion spirit hates this idea of having all these kids, big families, that's not a positive, blessed thing. You think of it. Also, the war on gender and the rise of gay activism. None of these things by nature will reproduce the next generation. I'm not saying there are not gay couples that care about children. I don't say that. But by nature, they cannot reproduce. By the nature of that relationship. And you think, look at this. Here you have Jezebel trying to kill the babies in the womb. Here you have Jezebel trying to break down the very fabric of the American family, even break down, or the family in general, even break down the male-female distinctives. It is a hellish attack on a multi-generational family mentality of be fruitful and multiply that God established in creation. It's not coincidence that all this is happening at the same time. And friends, Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world that it leaves to its children. And we need to be thinking about it. It's so interesting that many who are concerned about the climate, and I'm no expert on that, I'm making no comments on that, but many who are so concerned about the climate and what kind of world we leave to the next generation is not producing the next generation. I mean, it's kind of ironic to be so concerned that the world will be preserved and we won't have a crisis if climate change is man-caused. And again, I'm making no comment on that either way. But it's so interesting to have, you know, you're concerned about the trees and you're concerned about the rivers and you're concerned about the ice caps and all this. And you're not concerned about the kids in the womb and the babies and children being born and family life. But friends, if we do not have a multi-generational mentality, if we allow ground to be taken on our watch, our kids, our grandkids are going to say, what were you doing? What were you doing when they took away our religious rights? What were you doing when they introduced all these perverse curricula in our school? What were you doing? What were you doing when the American Library Association endorsed drag queens reading to toddlers in libraries? What were you doing? So I close with this passage, Isaiah chapter 39. Isaiah chapter 39. When you list some of the greatest kings in Israel's history, in the history of Israel and Judah, Hezekiah is up there. He's in the top few as a godly king, a reformer, a man who turned to God in urgent times, a man who restored worship and purified the temple. He's one of the great ones. But here's something really tragic. He almost dies, and we read about that in Isaiah 37. Isaiah 38, he sings a praise, a hymn of praise to God. And he says this, the living, they will praise you. The fathers to the sons, as I'm doing this today. He understood the multi-generational part. I've been miraculously healed. I'm going to tell my son about it, and he's going to tell his son. It's the living who will praise you. Now, Isaiah 39, he's recovered from his illness, and envoys come from Babylon to celebrate his healing and all of this. Why are there envoys from Babylon? Why do they care about Hezekiah? Because they have a common enemy, Assyria. And this is obviously a political meeting. Hey, Hezekiah, we're glad you're better. And Hezekiah says, hey, check out what I have. I can be a really good ally. So he shows him everything in the palaces, all the treasures of the nation. Then he leaves. They leave, and look at what happens. Verse 3, then Isaiah the prophet went to Hezekiah and asked, what are those men saying? Where did they come from? From a distant land, Hezekiah replied. They came to me from Babylon. The prophet asked, what did they see in your palace? They saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, in Hebrew it's sons, but means future generations, some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will be eunuchs. They will be castrated. They'll be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Now stop there. What would you do if you heard that word? God, no. Let the judgment fall on me. God, I've sinned. Don't punish the next generation. Don't punish my kids and my grandkids and future generations. I'm guilty. I alone sinned. Let the judgment fall on me. That would be a normal response. But look at this. Verse 8. The word of the Lord you have spoken is good, Hezekiah replied, for he thought, there will be peace and security in my lifetime. Wow is right. Well, praise the Lord. Everything's going to be okay for me. It doesn't matter if destruction comes on my kids and grandkids. Unbelievable. Well, Hezekiah should have been dead, but God extended his life 15 years. And it was during that time he had a son. As far as we could tell, he didn't have a son before then. And that's one reason he didn't want to die. His son was named Manasseh. Manasseh was the most wicked king in Judah's history. And because his sins were so horrific, future generations went into exile. It would seem that somehow Hezekiah failed to adequately pass on to his son Manasseh, who was apparently 12 when Hezekiah died. Somehow he failed to pass on to him the reality of the God he knew and worshiped. Friends, you don't want to have the Hezekiah mentality. You don't want to say, hey, as long as I'm okay, my job's good, I'm healthy, I've got a place to stay, everything's good, my family's good. No. We want to have God's heart. God's heart is multi-generational. And until Jesus returns, we continue that multi-generational mentality. And it is the will of God. It is the will of God for Mercy Culture to be a multi-generational congregation that has a multi-generational mentality, that is always thriving with new life physically and spiritually, that is always honoring fathers and mothers, that is always looking for what God is doing today so that there can be blessing tomorrow.